Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Darren Slade, a theologian from Denver, Colorado, who holds a Master's of Arts in Theological Studies and a Master's of Divinity from Liberty University. He is currently a PhD student at Liberty University in the fields of Christian theology and apologetics. Darren's research interest includes the influence of schismatic Christologies on the development of Islam, as well as the early church's inconsequential views on the mode of baptism. His scholarship on both these topics was recently published in the academic journal American Theological Inquiry. Darren has written extensively on a variety of biblical and religious topics, and you can find many of his writings on the website academia.edu, which is where I stumbled across him and his very intriguing paper on missionizing North Korea, of all things. And that will be the topic of today's discussion. This issue of missionizing North Korea is all the more timely, given that in just a month or so, Seth Rogen and James Franco plan to release the film The Interview, wherein they have a plotline aimed at assassinating the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, and that leader has, in real life, threatened war if the movie is released. Darren, welcome to Research on Religion.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And just for the record, I'm seriously thinking about spending Christmas Day going to see that Seth Rogen movie.
I thought it comes out in October.
Yeah, it was supposed to. They changed the date to Christmas Day.
They changed it to Christmas Day because they're thinking that Kim Jong-un will be otherwise preoccupied exchanging gifts with all the people in his country.
Yay! He tends to be a lot more merciful on the Christian holiday.
Well, there you go. So that works out pretty good. Before we get into this North Korea stuff, there's a couple things that you do, and you're very broad-ranging in your interest. You have these things on schismatic Christologies and the influence they have on Islam, and also the inconsequentialist views on the mode of baptism in the early church. Give us quick elevator summaries of what those things are about.
Yeah, my first article that was published with American Theological Inquiry dealt with the schismatic Christologies, and that means pretty much the heretical views of Christ that originated in the 4th and 5th centuries, and their influence on the development of Islam. So what I did was I tracked a lot of these heretical movements, for instance, the Nestorians, the Monophysites, some of the Gnostics, the Arians. A lot of them were kicked out of the broader Christendom landscape and were sent to Arabia. And that's kind of where all the heretics fled to. And so I wanted to see if those heresies actually influenced Muhammad on his development of Christ and how Jesus is portrayed in the Quran.
Very interesting. That might be a future topic here in Research on Religion. I didn't even know what that meant when I saw schismatic Christologies. It sounded too difficult to pronounce for me. But how about this other one, inconsequentialism of baptism in the early church?
Yeah, this one was also published with American Theological Inquiry. And what I did was I analyzed the Greek and Latin texts of the church fathers prior to the 4th century to discover which mode of baptism was most predominant in the early church, and if it even mattered, if they cared at all. And what I had found was that predominantly the early church fathers were not concerned about which mode of baptism you used, whether you immersed somebody or whether you just poured water over them. They were primarily focused on the faith, the genuine faith and character of the person being baptized.
Oh, No, that's pretty cool. We've had cowboy preachers on the show in the past, and they dunk people in the horse troughs. So I'm sure that the early church wouldn't have cared about that. So
that's a great idea. That's awesome.
Hey, what's ever available? I guess that's the thing. So there you have it. Anyways, let's get on to the stuff on North Korea, and this popped up on my academia.edu, and this is where you'll find your other papers, and we'll link back to those. It pops up there and says missionizing North Korea, and I'm like, rah? Because, I mean, of all the, I guess, non-Islamic places on earth, North Korea has to have the least amount of Christians. And one would think, well, that would be a pretty good place to missionize. But on the other hand, it has one of the most repressive, crazy, wackiest types of regimes around. And I could not imagine that being fertile soil for missionizing, just given the political landscape there. So the question is, how would anybody come across writing a paper on missionizing North Korea?
Yeah, no, you know, you're right. In fact, North Korea has the highest rate of atheists and agnostics than any other country. About 71% of the population is non-religious. But how I got interested in North Korea was back in college. This is where I actually first got saved. I was a brand new young Christian, and a buddy of mine took me down to Midland, Texas. We drove down there during the summer for one of their annual Rock the Desert Evangelism Crusades. And while we were there, there was a big tent set up that was dedicated to speaking out about the persecutions and atrocities taking place in North Korea. And I don't remember who was hosting the exhibit, but it changed my life. I remember walking into the tent, into the entrance, with having color still in my face. And when I left, I was as pale as a ghost. The tent had drawings, photos, testimonies, and they even had actual TVs stationed around the place that displayed smuggled video footage from inside North Korea that showed actual public executions of Christians, or the medical experiments that they conduct on Christians in these concentration camps.
Ooh.
And after I was exposed to that, I've had a heart for North Koreans ever since. So fast forward a few years, I finally get to seminary, and I've learned how to conduct personal evangelism. I've learned all the different theories and practices behind international missiology. And so now I wanted to take the opportunity to write about how to effectively evangelize North Korea. My wife and I are now actually financial supporters of a ministry called Voice of the Martyrs, which specializes in clandestine missionary operations in and around hostile countries. We give monthly to their North Korean Safe House Ministry, which is a chain of safe houses scattered across the border between China and North Korea that helps protect North Korean refugees who flee the country. And for those refugees who want to actually return back to North Korea, the safe houses provide evangelistic training so they can share the gospel with their friends and family.
Now, you mentioned that you got involved in this with your wife, and as I understand, your wife has done some missionary work. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. She was an international missionary for King's Kids, which is a subset of Youth with a Mission, YWAM. She did missionary trips all over the world with them for about 7 years.
Okay, so you got some experience in this regard. Have you ever been to North Korea?
No, I actually still have my freedom, so no.
Yeah. It is one of these interesting places that it's hard to get into, and so it's hard to write about. But it's what you're saying in this kind of thing. You've investigated this pretty thoroughly. It's looking from the outside in is an interesting vantage point here. So let's go ahead and dig into that. You've been interested in this topic. It's had a personal influence on you. And I think everybody knows that North Korea is probably one of the most totalitarian and atheistic regimes in existence today. And it really does set new standards for that term that we often hear, cult of personality worship. It's perhaps only rivaled by Turkmenistan recently. How did we get to this point in North Korea?
Yeah, that's a real good question. Unfortunately, it's enormously complex. There's a multitude of socio-political determinants that have all really come together to create this ghastly situation in North Korea. I think that those who study religion and the social sciences would agree that what we see in North Korea is, in fact, a real large-scale, massive religious cult. And I know that sounds like a contradiction, because here we are saying that they're a largely atheistic country, and yet they're also a religious cult. But where traditional religion would normally be, the North Korean state and her leaders have actually become the all-encompassing focus of the North Korean people. I mean, they've replaced worship of God with worship of the state. And this is largely due to several factors in Korean history that made the creation of a cult a real smooth transition. For instance, in terms of ethics and government systems, the overall philosophy of social and family relationships, the advent of Confucianism into the Korean peninsula in about the 4th century B.C. is by far the most dominant reason or characteristic that set the stage for a cult-like society. And this is because Confucian philosophy stresses loyalty and obedience to higher authorities. And this is exactly what we see in the current situation in North Korea. Now, add to that the Japanese occupation of the Korean Peninsula back in 1910 that lasted for 35 years. And it resulted in severe persecution and oppression of the Korean people. And you suddenly start to develop a real fine mixture of predisposing factors that lead to a cult. One of the most ironic pieces about North Korea's history is that it was actually Christian and Buddhist leaders who started a national movement to eradicate the Japanese occupation. And this in turn led to communist resistance fighters fighting to free their country from Japan. And of course, one of those fighters ended up being Kim Il-sung, who is the actual founder of the North Korean dictatorship.
You mentioned I pause you a minute there. You mentioned that there was some resistance from Christian and Buddhist leaders during the Japanese occupation, so during the first half of the 20th century. To what extent was Christian influence important in North Korea? Were there a lot of Christians, say, in, 1900, 1890 or so?
Absolutely. There was a growing increase in Christianity at the time. What we have is missionary activities, primarily from Catholics, that started back in the 1700s. By 1945, the majority of the population is Christian. But go ahead, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No. Go continue on. It's very interesting because, again, today we associate South Korea with being a rapidly Christianizing and pretty intensely Christian nation. I mean, they got some fervent believers, and they are exporting missionaries around the world. And so this is coming from somewhere. So it starts with the Catholics back in the 1700s. Any Protestants get in there?
Right. The Catholics started in the 1700s organizing operations in China, which was met pretty early on with severe persecution and martyrdom as well for Christianity. By 1884, we're looking at about 18,000 Catholic believers in Korea. Protestant missions started as well, but a little bit later after the Catholics, primarily from the Presbyterians and Methodist denominations. We're looking in the 1800s as well. So that's how we got the Korean Peninsula to become primarily Christian by the time of the Korean War.
And this creates this big, huge split. And nowadays we have South Korea, which is, as I mentioned before, a pretty vibrant Christian nation. I would have, maybe not 100%, but certainly you get some lots of Christian activity there. And the North, not at all. So what happens here in this divide?
Once the communist revolution takes place in the North, the United States, and this is before the Korean War, back in 1945, the United States suggests that we divide the country at what's known as the 38th parallel. And that's what created the two countries, North and South. By dividing a country like this, they ended up splitting about 10 million families from each other. With the capitalists in the South, the communists in the North, we're looking at extreme suspicion and hostility almost right away. In terms of religion, half of the Christians that are in the North end up fleeing to the South, where about only 25,000 Christians remained in the North. And what we see next is pretty much a systematic elimination of any competition in the country, religious competition. And that's because Kim Il-sung is starting to develop his personality cult. And he's starting to institute his new ideology. It's called the Juche ideology.
What is this Juche ideology?
Yeah, it's really a low-level, unsophisticated philosophical system. And it pretty much just stresses only a few things. The term Juche actually just means self-reliance, and it's pretty ironic because the people are, in fact, wholly dependent on the state for everything. But Juche demands a complete devotion to the state and her politics. It spreads intense paranoia and extreme nationalism. It's overly preoccupied with isolationism. So, and again, this paranoia, that unquestioning devotion and isolating the people from, you know, what North Korea might call the evils of the world, these are all characteristics of the personality cult developing in North Korea.
So how does this cult of personality develop? And this is one of these interesting historical things that in the middle part of the 20th century, early part of the 20th century, you see a lot of this. You get the characters such as Mussolini and Hitler and Stalin and Lenin and Mao. Just, you know, even though these nations are supposed to be emphasizing the state as an organic whole and we're all in this together, this ideology, and oftentimes of self-reliance as well, as you mentioned, the Juche, but these ideologies are floating around there in the first half of the 20th century. They tend to focus on one individual, which is really interesting.
Absolutely. And it's to be expected, too. We have to recognize exactly what's happening at this point in history. Here you have a group of people that's largely authoritarian already. Because of things like Confucianism, they already believe in living strict, regimented lives. They already have a real strong sense of obedience and loyalty to authority figures. You know, now you add in a sense of disenchantment with the world because of the Japanese oppression. And then you add in another mix of the strong idealism that's present in communist revolution. And you suddenly have a people who are enamored with the idea of being a part of something that's bigger and better than themselves. These are all predisposing factors that create personality cults all over the world. The Kim personality cult, in particular, is really morbid, especially from our perspective. We have reports coming out of North Korea that say that the North Korean people ascribe mythical powers to the great leaders. And what I mean by the great leaders, I mean Kim Il-sung, who was the founder of North Korea, and his son, Kim Jong-il, who died in 2011. The people tend to actually worship the great leaders as gods. You know, in fact, state propaganda actually tells the North Korean people that outside their country, that we Americans actually worship Kim Il-sung as a god.
And that's really interesting to see how this manifests itself. And if you look at some of the posters that come from North Korea, you'll see pictures of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung with these like glowing halos around them. I mean, what other kind of manifestations of this cult of personality are there?
Well, you know, anybody who's actually seen footage coming out of North Korea of how they respond to the great leaders, it's really quite astounding, and it's almost beyond bizarre and eccentric. I remember watching one documentary where an eye surgeon gained permission to enter North Korea with a film crew, and he was going to perform operations on these North Koreans on their eyes to help them regain their sight. And he did, you know, several dozen operations. But the film footage of how these people responded was unbelievable. They are falling to their knees, or some are jumping up and down in ecstasy. Tears are just plummeting from their face. They are crying hysterically and worshiping pictures of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, thanking them and praising them for having healed their eyesight.
So they're not saying, thank you, optometrist, for your wonderful services. They're heading on their first sight is going over to the poster of Kim Jong-il and saying, whoa, dude, that's awesome.
Yes. Wow. And it is amazing watching them, because if we could get Christians to be as crazy about Christ as these North Koreans are about the great leaders, we might have some real strong evangelism in the world. Now, you know, the North Korean regime requires the North Korean people to do several things to honor the leaders. They have to wear lapel pins that bear Kim Il-sung's image. Every home, every business, every factory, every school, all automobiles, they all have to have pictures of the great leaders prominently displayed. They have statues of the great leaders in every town. This is a cult. One of my favorite stories, although it's also probably the most horrendous, was by a guy named James Brook from the New York Times. He actually investigated a fire that occurred in 2004 in North Korea, and it killed 161 North Koreans. So, you know, this is a major tragedy. But instead of lamenting the deaths of these Koreans, the state regime actually praised the actions of many North Koreans who left children inside to die in the burning building in order to save pictures of the great leaders. These North Koreans actually let their own children die and risk their own lives just to save pictures of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il.
Wow. Let me ask a question. I know this is going to be very difficult to answer because it's just, from a social scientific standpoint, methodologically difficult to get some leverage on, but you look into this society and you say, wow, that these people either really believe or they're really afraid, and that they don't believe, but they're just feigning this belief out of fear of being punished or persecuted. Do you have any sense to what extent this outpouring of love for the great leaders and this cult of personality is really real, or is it just walking through the motions so that you don't get sent to prison camp?
You know, I definitely think there's part of both, but on whole, the majority, my sense is that this is real. They genuinely love the great leaders, and I don't necessarily think they have the ability to critically think about it or answer why. We're looking at a people who have been so indoctrinated and brainwashed for several generations now that it is not only expected, but it is natural for them to praise and love the great leaders. And you know, one of the reasons I say this is because even among defectors, people who fled North Korea, even among them, there is still a deep love and reverence for the great leaders.
I guess that's one way you could get at it. People who fled the country, they say, well, this sucks. I want to go somewhere else. But then you ask them, you must really hate your great leader. And they say, no, great leader is really good. And that, hey, there's some kind of strange discontinuity there. And I also think this is going to affect missionizing strategies, because if you have individuals so enchanted with one great leader, how do you turn them over to Jesus or other religious faiths? So that's going to be kind of interesting. Before we get to that missionizing aspect, though, I want to focus on one more thing of the cult of personality. a lot of it is talked about Kim Jong-il, the son of Kim Il-sung, and Kim Il-sung looms very large as well. Well, we're now on our third Kim leader here, and that's Kim Jong-un. He's been around for, about 3 or 4 years now? And is he part of this great leaders thing? I mean, just because he gets to be promoted to the new leader, does he get a spot equal on the pantheon of great leaders, or is he number three in the totem pole?
No, he's definitely number three. He does not have the same type of reverence that Kim Il-sung would have. Even Kim Jong-il didn't have the same reverence. But that's not to say the cult personality is not there. We still have those same personality or cult characteristics in both Kim Il, Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un. They still extract blind obedience from their followers. They still tend to be very paranoid, and they still tend to see themselves as some kind of a messiah figure. But the good news for us when it comes to evangelizing North Korea is that the farther away we get from Kim Il-sung, the less cultic devotion we see among the people.
Let's talk about that, and let's talk about the nature of Christianity in North Korea now, because there is some. There's not a whole lot, but there is some. So give us the landscape of Christianity in North Korea since about 1950 or maybe 1953 after the Korean War effectively ends, even though it hasn't been declared to be an end yet. So,
the status of Christianity in North Korea is pretty bleak. My research indicates it's the eighth least religiously free country in the world. Number one is Saudi Arabia. Less than 40% of the population has even been evangelized. The highest estimate of Christians in the country is roughly 2% of the population. The population is over 24 million. But now that's a high estimate. Others suggest that there's only about 100,000 Christians in the country. In terms of Christian literature, there are fewer than 1,800 complete Bibles in the entire country. There was one survey that was done on 755 different defectors from North Korea, and of those 700, only 4% had ever seen a Bible, and only 1% had ever attended a house church. So now, Christianity is definitely not flourishing at all.
And yet there's been a number of individuals who have attempted to make their way into the country. I mean, one of the, I don't want to say stars, that's not the right term, but one of the figures who comes up quite a bit is this guy named Kenneth Bai. He's somebody who's been trying to missionize the territory, and he's been in prison. Tell us a little bit about him and the status of Christian martyrs.
I don't know much about Kenneth Bai. I know he's an American, Korean-American, which is pretty standard. It's pretty typical, because my understanding is that the people who are most exuberant about trying to evangelize North Korea have some kind of an invested interest in North Korea. So, as you mentioned before, South Korea is largely Christian, and so they're very much bent on trying to evangelize and missionize North Korea. We also have former loyal North Koreans who tried to evangelize as well. In fact, the Fourth River Project was started by a guy named Hyun-sik Kim, and he was not only a loyal party member, but actually tutored children in the Kim household. And now he defected and is going back to North Korea trying to evangelize. So with people like Kenneth Bai, I think it's pretty typical for Korean-Americans or for Koreans in general to have a real heart to see peace and unity back on that Korean peninsula.
Now, one of the things that you also mentioned when you talked about the defectors coming back and I'm sure they're asked a lot of questions. What's it like to live there? What's the status of Christianity? You said 1% had been associated with or had attended or knew about these things called house churches. And I know about these house churches in China. We've featured several podcasts on this topic with Carrie Casel, but I was unaware that they had them in North Korea. They must be small in number and also pretty small in size. I mean, in China, some of these house churches can be hundreds and even up to 1,000 people in big warehouses. So it's not quite a house church. But I can imagine in a much more repressive society like North Korea, having 100 people gather would be pretty difficult. So what is the status of these house churches in North Korea?
Yeah, again, we're looking at a real bleak situation here. We have to understand that Christians are not just persecuted, but they're exterminated in North Korea. Since 1950, there's been, on average, over 10,000 Christians murdered every single year. Mm. We're looking at 820,000 Christian martyrs, people who have been killed just for spreading the gospel, in North Korea's history. So when we look at the house churches, we're looking at a situation where only two or three people can actually gather around. And when they are together, they're hiding under blankets, reading their Bibles, under cover of darkness. And one of the saddest things is that in North Korea, children are generally not allowed to attend these house churches. And that's simply because of the fear that they might accidentally disclose information about the church meetings to informants. Because, you know, North Korea actually routinely hires children, and they have an entire government agency designed to sniff out these house churches and other illegal Christian activities. And once you're found out, once you're found out to be a Christian in North Korea, you're subject to disappearance, imprisonment, torture, and execution.
Yeah, that's not a good thing. And I know, you know, kids don't have filters on them, and so it's hard for them to keep a secret. And I can imagine that this is going to play a big role in missionizing, because one of the big missionizing strategies of many Christian churches is youth groups. And, well, youth groups probably not the smartest tactic in North Korea, I would guess. Let me go back and ask you, this is in reference again to China, and I know a lot about Chinese, how they manage their religious landscape or their political economy of religion. And the Chinese government basically has these three tiers of religiosity. And the sociologist at Purdue, Fengen Yang, has called them the red, gray, and black markets. The black market churches are the ones that are considered very threatening and are severely repressed. But they also have these gray markets, which are not officially recognized, but they're tolerated. The regime turns a blind eye to some of these house churches, so long as they don't upset the system. And then Fengen Yang also talks about this red market, which is an official state Christian church in China. Does North Korea have any semblance of that, or is this all just church of, or a cult of personality?
That's a really good question. Officially, North Korea does say that they have three church buildings, that there are about 500 house churches and something around 12,000 Christians. So they do officially recognize that Christianity is present in the country, and they pretend that it's okay to have it there. But in terms of the three tier, I would say it's pretty much just black market. Here's what I mean. The three church buildings that are actually present in North Korea, two of them are in the capital city. And the irony is that Christians are forbidden from entering the capital city. So a report from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom by the United States said that those three churches are pretty much just for show. They're a facade. There's absolutely no religious activity going on in those buildings.
So when a tourist comes in and says, hey, how's your religious freedom? They say, hey, come here, look at the church.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
And North Korea dramatically underplays the role of house churches and present as well. While they officially recognize 500, it's more like 21,000. There's probably about 21,000 house churches in North Korea.
Why would you think they recognize the presence of some of them to begin with? I mean, if these things are so threatening, why not just say, hey, none of them exist? Why even bother with 500?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, if they would just say that there isn't any and that all the people are loyal to the Kim cult, you know, it'd look better for them. I see in North Korea, the politics have a real strong tension. On the one hand, they're a hermit nation. They have communications blackout. They don't trust anybody. They badger everyone else, or they're very aggressive. But on the other hand, the leaders really want to be seen as a legitimate authority. So they want to legitimize themselves. And they know that the only way to be legit on the international scene is to make it look like you have some semblance of religious freedom.
Yeah, I guess that would be the case for them. So let's get into the topic of missionizing. And I can imagine that this is going to be pretty rough territory. It's largely a black market religious economy, as Feng Yang would call it. And it's going to be hard to crack that nut, so to speak. But you talk about a number of different strategies. And when I saw this paper, my first thought was I was a bit surprised that anybody would want to missionize North Korea to begin with. I mean, if I was a missionary organization, I would say, well, there are a lot more fertile and safer territories to expend resources on, or a bigger bang for the buck if you go somewhere else in the world, to Africa or other places in Asia. Why would anybody choose to make North Korea a mission territory?
Yeah, like we discussed with Kenneth Bai, I think these people have a personal investment, but outside of the Korean scene, the only thought I can think of is, other than the fact that Christ didn't really call us to evangelize only where it's convenient and easy, is that North Korea provides an opportunity for Christians to actually feel like they're making a strong impact on the kingdom. When we recognize that Christians are being persecuted and murdered in a country, and they're systematically being eliminated, being able to help them, it's not your standard routine, mundane missionary work that you would normally do maybe in Uganda or something. I think North Korea provides Christians an actual feeling of making a larger impact on the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is tough ground. I mean, you're starting from basically ground zero, so anything is going to be a major improvement.
Right.
Yeah. So what are some of the strategies that are in use right now? So there's obviously people that are focused on this. You mentioned Kenneth Bai. There's also folks, Mike Kim and a few other folks that are trying to get people in. You've talked about the Voice of the Martyrs, the Safe House project that they have. What are some of the current missionary strategies to try to break in to North Korea with the Christian message?
Yeah, I'd say that there's probably two main focuses. The most effective strategies that are being implemented right now usually involve either humanitarian efforts inside the country or more covert operations from outside the country. So, for instance, there are several Christian organizations that have established soy milk and noodle factories inside the country, and they employ North Koreans. This is especially effective because it allows North Koreans an opportunity to build a trusting relationship with foreigners. And I guess that's one of the things that we really want to stress and I really want to communicate. That's very important. We must expose North Koreans to foreigners and get them to recognize that we are not out to harm them. The other good thing about these food factories is that they provide opportunities for the Christians to personally witness to the individual North Koreans, who can then turn around and evangelize their family and friends. I specifically think of World Vision. They do an especially good job at this. Through different diplomatic and economic strategies, they've been able to travel to different villages in North Korea and deliver humanitarian aid directly to the people. And again, this exposes the North Koreans to foreigners and improves our image with the people.
Let me try to get a handle on how this actually works. You mentioned this in the paper, and I tried thinking through the nuts and bolts of it. I'm very much a nuts and bolts. How does this happen? Step A, step B, step C. So you have an organization like World Vision or any other humanitarian agency, and they set up a soy milk factory. That's one of the examples that you used in your paper. Why, first of all, why would the regime allow that? I mean, they're very xenophobic, afraid of foreigners coming in. It's part of the Juche self-reliance, the ideology that's there. Why would they let somebody come in with a soy milk factory?
Well, you know, they haven't always. And it is extremely difficult. The Kim regime has, in fact, repeatedly tried to stop and squash any foreign aid and humanitarian work being done. So getting placed in the country, I'm sure that you cannot announce that you're a Christian organization, or you need to do some diplomatic finagling, for sure. But why they even would allow it, quite simply, their people are starving, and they don't have the means to feed their own people.
I guess when push comes to shove, that comes down to it, is that no matter how repressive your country is, you do have to keep your population alive. And yes, poverty is pretty big. Tell us a little bit about the socioeconomic state of the Koreans, the North Koreans, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's, again, very bleak. 90% of imported food into the country is from foreign assistance programs. You know, international aid feeds a third of the entire population in North Korea. And that's because only 20% of the land is actually arable and can be used for agriculture. And like I said, the Kim regime has repeatedly tried to stop this. You know, I've written some statistics down here. The average North Korean eats only 2 meals a day, and that usually consists of corn gruel or potato plant stems and tofu. As of 2010, one-third of all the children and one-quarter of all mothers in North Korea are malnourished. Only about 25% of factories are operational, and the average North Korean worker, one that's actually lucky enough to have a job, makes only enough money to feed himself for a week. You know, he doesn't make enough money to feed his family. Mm-hmm. In 2005, the World Food Program said that 7% of North Korean children are wasting, 37% are stunted, 23% are underweight. There was a report in 1998 that said that 47% of the residents in the capital city had access to clean water. And this is actually really quite remarkable, because the capital city is the hub of all party loyal members. So the richest and wealthiest people live in the capital city, and yet less than half had access to clean water. Yeah. You can imagine what the rest of the country is suffering with. The average North Korean lives with one or two chronic diseases. The average adult is 3 inches shorter and 7 pounds lighter than their counterpart in South Korea.
Now, that is an amazing statistic. And, you know, one methodologically could talk about, well, you know, how do you measure malnourishment and that? There's a lot of social science debate over that stuff. But when you start talking about the size, the height of people, that encompasses a lot of different things like malnourishment, access to clean water, disease, all those different things. And, you know, since the 1950s, after the Korean War, when the two countries divide, I mean, you got essentially a natural experiment here in the South. They're 3 inches taller than they are in the North. And that's a huge difference.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I even read a report recently that had said that South Korea actually throws away more food than North Koreans will eat all year long. So the poverty is extreme in North Korea.
And with that in mind, you can understand how the government would say, okay, we're having a little bit of a problem feeding our folks. They're shorter on average than down in South Korea. Yeah, humanitarian aid come in. There's a tension there. We don't want it to come in, but we need it to come in. So it comes in. You get folks like World Vision and other humanitarian aid groups coming in. Now, in terms of the Christian missionizing, and you talk a little bit about this in the paper, the exposure to foreigners is very important. So the foreigner from World Vision, and oh, by the way, World Vision is actually located out not too far from me here in Federal Way, Washington. And so they go in and set up a soy milk factory or something like that. Does missionizing take place there? And if so, how does it? I can't imagine that they say, well, you know, an hour before work, we're going to have a big prayer session, because I'm assuming that the government has somebody there watching that and they say, that's not what you're going to do.
You know, ironically, that actually might be what's happening in a lot of cases.
Really?
There have been reports that you can actually go into a factory and see people praying and reading their Bibles. So it does look like some of these factories, at least some of the time, are safe havens for Christian activity. What are the exact methods that they're using, that some of these missionaries are using? I'm sure there isn't one definitive mold that they're, or method. I'm sure it depends. I would argue that most definitely there has to be a long period of trust building and building of relationships, getting to know them on an intimate level, the individual North Korean employees, and also screening, making sure that somebody isn't an informant or somebody that could close the factory down by reporting on you. So I think probably well before the gospel message is presented, they have to build a lot of relationship and connection with the North Koreans.
And that's fairly common with a lot of missionary strategies in different parts of the world. And you build a relationship first. People learn to trust you. And you gradually say, hey, you know, I've been reading this thing called the Bible. You want to hear about it. And you just do it casually and slowly. It's not a, you know, coming in with arms waving and polyester suits saying amen and hallelujah alone.
You make a fantastic point, because that's essential when it comes to evangelism here at home or evangelizing abroad. People are not targets, and our goal is not to persuade or to argue. Our goal is to build a relationship with people. And we have to recognize that people have their own worldviews, and when we ask them to change and adopt ours, that needs a lot of trust, and they need to realize that it's what has made a major difference in our lives.
So that's the humanitarian strategy. Bring in some soy milk factories, some noodle factories, build some trust, exposure to foreigners, gradually bring people over by building a relationship. You also mentioned earlier that there are covert strategies. Tell us about some of these.
These are definitely my favorites. Some of the covert operations that take place are usually smuggling operations. So they'll smuggle Bibles or other Christian literature into the country. They smuggle blankets, medicine, food into the country. Voice of the Martyrs, I think, does probably the best job when it comes to these covert operations. And they have a pretty inventive method for clandestine evangelism. They're called balloon drops.
Balloon drops?
Right, and this is by far my favorite strategy. I actually own one of the balloons that they drop in North Korea. It's hanging up in my wall right now. What they do is they fill two different types of balloons with hydrogen fuel, and they fill these up in South Korea. They wait for the right type of weather conditions, and then they let the balloons fly into North Korea on these wind currents. And if they go undetected, the smaller balloons simply have the gospel message written on the balloon. So, for instance, one side of the balloon will have the Gospel of Mark written on it, and the other side will have kind of a picture, how to know God tract kind of thing. So they usually fly over North Korea, they run out of their fuel, and they land onto the countryside for North Koreans to read. The larger balloons are actually filled with small Bibles, gospel tracts, shortwave radios, food, medicine, cash, clothing. So they fill these bigger balloons with goodies. And on the bottom of the balloons, they have a timed charge so that at a certain point in its flight, the balloon will release its contents over the country, primarily, of course, over the impoverished portions of the country.
That probably wouldn't be too hard to find, the impoverished part of the country.
Right.
Pretty big target there. How big are these balloons? I mean, you talk about a small size and a big size. You say you have one hanging on your wall. How small is the small? How big is the big?
I haven't seen the big one. They look like little blimps from the pictures I've seen, but I haven't seen one in real life. The smaller one is probably the size of a good TV.
Wow.
So maybe what we would think of two or three balloons put together.
Okay. Well, that's pretty interesting. You mentioned some of the things that the larger balloons drop in are radios. Why radios?
There's several organizations out there that have radio broadcasts. There's Open Radio for North Korea and Free North Korea Radio. They send in radio signals into the country that air Christian reports, Christian gospel messages, things like that. So the shortwave radio is the real easy way for the North Koreans to have first actual communication outside the country. We have to realize that it is a complete communications blackout in North Korea. So only sanctioned material is allowed in. What the radio waves do is allow outside communication to penetrate the Hermit Kingdom.
I can imagine there's got to be something like Radio Free Europe that operates in that part of the world, right?
Free Europe. Yeah. And, you know, it's a really quite clever way of doing it because both of these strategies with the balloon drops, the radio drops, things like that, North Korea has noticed it and has consistently petitioned South Korea to stop the activity. So it seems to be working.
Mm-hmm. Now, in addition to some of these strategies, your paper talks about strategies to avoid. So you got noodle factories, the humanitarian efforts work really well, building strong relationships with the people who are there. You have the covert, fly things in with a balloon, put in some radios, some shortwave radio broadcasts, possibly some smuggling across rivers and things like that. What are some of the things that Christians should be worried about avoiding?
Well, the Christian missionary needs to recognize that evangelizing in North Korea is not like you would do in other parts of the world. Many of the methods are very counterintuitive and can even appear counterproductive. One of the most surprising things that I learned about North Korea is that they are a child nation. And what I mean by this is that the North Korean cult has indoctrinated the people into believing that they are, in fact, a pure race with childlike innocence. So they don't have any concept of intellectual discourse, of critical thinking, or being able to even support themselves. I mean, they are told that they are children and that the Kim regime is their parent and that they're taken care of. So missionaries really need to avoid trying to engage in intellectual conversations with them or attempt to persuade them of the evils of their country. Quite frankly, the North Koreans may not know any better. We probably should resort to more childlike evangelism tactics with puppet shows and cartoons. We also need to avoid sending Americans and, especially those of the white kind, and Japanese missionaries, because to the North Koreans, Americans and Japanese are imperialists, and we have an ulterior motive for being there. This also brings up kind of what we were talking about before with the admiration for the great leaders. We need to avoid criticizing the government or their economic policies or even the great leaders. And I know that this is probably the most counterintuitive aspect of missionizing. But we have to realize that we are not there to change governments, and we're not there to change foreign diplomacy. We are concerned with the salvation of souls, regardless of whether the person lives in a communist regime or a democracy. And something that Christians don't understand is that when we criticize the great leaders, we are putting a stumbling block in front of the gospel, because it's going to immediately create a feeling of distrust and suspicion. Well, and the last thing we need to avoid is trying to rush the process. This is a highly xenophobic people, and we need to have a certain amount of sensitivity and empathy on our part. So we have to realize that the North Koreans have had a lot of traumatic experiences. They're very uncertain about the world, and we're asking them to change their whole perspective on everything. We're asking them to change one, you know, quote-unquote spiritual authority figure for another. So the process needs to take time.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned, I want to come back to this issue of not criticizing the great leaders, and you wrote in the paper something that might be controversial among Christians, and you noted this a few minutes ago, was that you don't criticize the great leaders, but on top of it, a lot of the Bible tracts that are written maybe on some of these balloon drops or smuggling in, the Bible tracts are written with pictures of the great leader also included, or they'll be written over the great leader thing. And that almost, you know, to some Christians, that might sound very impure or very heretical, that how can you recognize this cult of personality yet put the gospel of Luke written on there as well?
Yeah, this is definitely the most controversial strategy. I do want to make clear, as far as I know, this has never happened. This is a strategy that I suggest. And it took a lot of soul searching before I was okay with even making the suggestion. We have to realize that evangelizing North Korea, like I said, is counterintuitive. And one of the biggest hindrances to the spread of the gospel is that the government confiscates and destroys Christian literature. But in North Korea, it is illegal to deface or hide a picture of Kim Il-sung. So my suggestion is purely pragmatic. I recommend printing gospel tracts or the gospel balloons or something on material that has a picture of Kim Il-sung on it, simply to avoid confiscation and destruction. And I'm not suggesting that we try to change the content of our message or try to associate Kim Il-sung with God, but imagine a group of Christians who are reading the Bible under their blankets in the middle of the night, and the secret police finds out about this, and they come barging through the door. And those North Koreans don't have time to bury their Bibles or hide their material. So if they had a picture of Kim Il-sung on it, and it didn't look like a Bible, then maybe the police wouldn't notice it at all. Or maybe they wouldn't want to risk defacing a picture of Kim Il-sung, so they leave it alone. I even thought about a strategy where maybe we identify a widely publicized book in North Korea and just copy its cover and print the Bible inside of that, so it looks like it's just one of those widely publicized books.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Let me address another controversial statement you made, and people listening to this might have some kind of reaction to this. You mentioned that the North Koreans have a very childlike culture, and some people would respond saying, that sounds really paternalistic. I mean, aren't we as Christians supposed to go out and meet people on their equal footing? We're all God's creatures created in God's image. How would you address maybe that critique of paternalism there?
It's a real strong tension. What we want to do when it comes to evangelism is not always what we should be doing. So there is this risk that we're going to continue playing into this child motif, these ethnic symbols of them being a pure race, and that we're just going to make them go from being dependent on the state to being dependent on foreign aid or dependent on Christian activity. And the only thing I really have to say to that is this is a very long process, and by no means is this going to be universal. The tactics will change, but we have to make inroads first. So we can't take a people who have such strong beliefs about who they are and where what their place is in the universe. We can't kidnap them from that so quickly. Instead, I think what we need to do is really meet them on their level, contextualize the gospel. So, for instance, with this childlike mentality, we can explain that even our God sees us as children and wants us to be pure, and that we see God as a parent figure. So while not necessarily endorsing their worldview 100%, we can show that there's some continuity between us and them.
Mm-hmm. Let me finish up here with a final question. And in your paper, which we will link to on our website, you offer a number of other very interesting ideas as well. And I encourage people to go there and look at this if you're interested. But my final question, and we have may have touched upon this a little bit earlier, is your prognosis for North Korea. It's one of these countries that just is utterly unique in the world, just for the amount of repression, for the cult of personality, for the extreme poverty that it faces. And every few months or so, we get some new threat from Kim Jong-un that he's going to nuke the United States, or you'll see a South Korea boat get torpedoed once a year or so, and we send in Dennis Rodman, things settle down for a little bit, but then it's lather, rinse, and repeat again. It just seems like such an intractable situation. What are your thoughts about where things are heading? Are you optimistic that there might be some decompression occurring, and that maybe not necessarily in the short term, but maybe in a decade or two decades, you'll start to see a greater opening, and the society will become more free, will experience a lot more social flourishing? What are your thoughts for the future?
Yeah, you know, with Kim Jong-un, it's a little bit of a different dynamic, because we're looking at a very untested, immature leader who is trying to posture to the world. He's trying to show that he is a force to be reckoned with. I'm actually cautiously optimistic about North Korea, though I'm sad about what was probably likely going to have to happen first. And here's what I mean. With Kim Jong-un, he has made some very decisively poor mistakes in his tenure so far. He's alienated his country from China. He's stopped peace talks with South Korea, which just further discredits him on the international scene. He has this real silly obsession with weapons, which is costing his country so much money that his economy is about to take. And more recently, just last year, he executed his uncle for trying to overthrow the Kim dynasty. Now, this uncle was second in command of the whole country. So this is a big deal. It communicates to the North Koreans that their country is not stable, that it is, there is no unanimous devotion to the Kim dynasty. And it may even indicate, and this is what I hope it indicates, to the world that there is an actual subversive plot to change North Korea from the inside out. Now, if there's even a hint of this being true, then a change in regime might actually make evangelizing North Korea a bit easier for us. Especially if a new regime adopts more China-like economic and diplomatic policies. Of course, I'm very saddened about what would have to happen for dramatic change to actually happen. That is that the North Korean people are still going to have to continue to suffer and endure hardship probably before any dramatic change happens.
It is a tough situation, but it's something that we will keep a close eye on. My guest today has been Darren Slade. Darren, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion.
To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.